Okay, shall we start? It's the final session of the day, and then we only have dinner left. I remember what this session is about. It's about the idea, how we're going to run it, we'll see, but it starts off with a set of presentations where each cluster has tried to work a little bit away from the thinking, the abstract thinking, into a set of, engaging a set of data, and how you would go about that. Now, clusters have done that in very different ways. Some have been produce stuff, some have reflected on what it would mean to do things, some have set up a particular procedure of working. So we'll see how that comes along. But I think the whole idea was to move from discussions about visuality, what it means, materiality, the big questions, into what does that mean in terms of engaging a data set or a set of data. And what data set would you select? I mean, you know all these questions that are surrounding. But we thought it might be very nice to start off not with our own clusters, just as to reduce the navel gazing a little bit, with someone who is folded, in the sense that I've just picked that word up, in the sense that he is an insider and outsider. Martin is, of course, part of the collaboratory, but we had asked him to present a little bit of his work that he actually does in relation to cases. And I'm really glad, Martin, because he almost could not make it. So I'm really happy he is here. Very briefly, I'll ask Martin to introduce himself a little bit. But Martin is Senior Lecturer in International Politics at Newcastle University, as I'm sure most of you know. And he works, I'm sure you work on much more than that, but he works on the urban environment from the perspective of materiality in relation to war. And I think you're going to talk a little bit about that, what that means, right? So it's partly from within the materialities kind of angle, but it's also about what does it mean to engage a situation or a site or whatever that is there in that way. And we thought that might be a nice way of opening up as giving a different perspective, someone who does that work in that way, and then move back. And we move people around quickly to present their cases, and then we might really have a discussion about what it means to engage and how that translation works from the reading groups and the discussions into the engaging of the data. Right, Martin, over to you.
Thank you. And it's been fantastic to actually be asked to spend 10 minutes thinking about method, because I haven't spent a huge amount of time thinking about how it's related to my work. Broadly speaking, I work on, I suppose the changing nature of conflict in the kind of broadest sense of the word, but more particularly on what I've come to call the urbanization of security. So more recently this is translated into a concern with the kind of material infrastructure of the city and its relationship to violence and security. But I'm going to talk about some work I did earlier on, which is the work I did on herbicide, or the wide-scale destruction of cities, particularly in the case of the Bosnian conflict, because it's sufficiently far now for me to reflect on it, and with a small amount of pain say that I got some things wrong and I'll identify which those things are in order to talk about how the method might have been done differently. I should start by saying that it's kind of say in terms of method, I don't think about method in terms of a kind of repeatable set of systematic procedures. I've thought about it much more in terms of delineating a field of inquiry consisting of a series of constitutive relations of assemblage that are either delineated or revealed in a particular way by the identification of a particular problematic. And so it's often the identification of a particular problematic that's important methodologically, because it's that, if you like, reveals a certain set of relations that then become the object of inquiry. And it strikes me that the question about how one starts to identify a problematic is also a question about how one intervenes in a particular field. And I think this is to pick up on some of the questions towards the end of the previous session about, if the question about what direction you take an inquiry in and where you stop is a question of political choice, this is about exercising precisely that political choice and becoming sensitive to the politics involved in that choice, which I take it is part of the question you're asking about authority and authorization. So it's methodologically, I think it's less about a series of procedures, but more about a series of kind of operative assumptions that are probably at the same time ontological, epistemological, political, ethical, and that these guide the intervention. And I guess that for me, I was interested in the systematic and widespread destruction of cities in Bosnia. I was interested in the way in which the urban fabric was destroyed in a way that was beyond strategy, beyond instrumental rationality, and beyond what we could comfortably call cultural genocide. That there was something much wider, that there was a kind of field of inquiry there, and that there was a problematic revealed in a kind of silence about the fact that we couldn't fully, if you like, or there was a clear kind of gap or silence in the field of inquiry about what was going on beyond strategy, beyond instrumental rationality, and beyond what we could call cultural genocide. I took it that this was the kind of widespread systematic destruction of urban fabric, material things, buildings, houses, flats, apartment blocks, car parks, shops, superstores, all of these kinds of things, shopping malls, these kinds of things. And in a way, what I wanted to do, or I framed it as a problematic of going beyond discourse. This was partly a kind of accidental framing because there was already a lot of very good discourse analysis of the Bosnian conflict, which was the conflict I wanted to look at. But I wanted to get away from the idea that the buildings were being destroyed only because they were playing a role within a wider discourse, which was, say, constitutive of ethnicity or something like that. And I wanted to come back to ask about the loss of things and to try and talk about what was lost when things were destroyed. And in this sense, I now come to realize, having read Jane Bennett's Vibrant Matter, that what I was involved in was, I think, what she calls a kind of certain naive or speculative inquiry. Certain naivety because it suspends some of the kind of more sophisticated questions about things and whether we can know things and how they're mediated through discourses and so on, and accepts a kind of suspension of those questions in order to look and say that things matter and we should talk about their loss before we talk about kind of discourses in some kind of way. And I suppose also that was also a kind of political and ethical choice. There was a lot of concern for the people of Bosnia, justly and rightly. Of course, there was a lot of concern. The genocide that was occurring, the massive refugee crisis and humanitarian crisis it produced, and so on, which had eclipsed the fact that the urban fabric of Bosnia was being systematically raised. And had not really asked kind of significant questions about what that loss might constitute. And this is best seen in, for example, there's an EU mission, the EU administration of Mostar, when it first goes to Mostar, never really asks the question of where people will live. It's actually mostly concerned with how people can get along. But of course, if people don't have anywhere to live, they're not going to get along. It was concerned with asking, in a kind of naive sense, how we might inquire about those things. Now, how does that translate into actually working through that case? I think I would say four things. One is, I mean, I was very fortunate that actually, although there was a gap about what that loss meant or how we could understand that loss, there was a growing but small amount of kind of documentation by international organizations, NGOs, concerned citizens, and so on, of precisely how destruction was mapping across the city. It was always left on a kind of... It was always left without much interpretation. You'd get kind of portfolios of destruction of Sarajevo, for example, that would say, here's the destruction of Sarajevo, isn't it terrible? Which, of course, it was. But there was no kind of serious interpretive frame put on the top. So there was a growing amount of sort of secondary literature mapping that destruction. There was also, for me, I think it required a sense that one had to spend some time in the area. I know that might sound obvious, but one of the things that bothers me most about accounts of urban insecurity is that they tend to interpret the urban environment from the perspective of their everyday experience. And so, for example, you know, They interpret the city as the city they live in, even if they've read secondary literature about the city they want to talk about. So there was a sense of kind of spending time there. But the problem here was that that time, or being concerned with things perhaps more than discourse, The question was, beyond noting that destruction had happened, what could one do? Because that destruction happened, that houses were lost, that there was widespread destruction was really the kind of main empirical base. And beyond checking that that was actually true, had happened, the question then was what could be done further. And in my work, that kind of boiled down to two kinds of secondary work. One was actually a kind of fairly Heideggerian phenomenology, which was basically a lexical, and which was basically kind of lexical, if you like. It went through the kinds of ways in which the prominent literature had talked about the experience of the urban, to think about how that related to what buildings might do within the context of the urban. The second was more ethnographic, but again in terms of secondary ethnographic analysis, looking at kind of discourses where discourses about how people spoke about loss, to kind of pick up on and feed into the sort of more lexical analysis of what the kind of key concepts were. And then thinking about how one might filter these three sort of components: lexical analysis of the literature, secondary ethnographic testimony, if you like, and kind of more primary data on actual loss of buildings, into some kind of political theory. Now, one of the kinds of clear critiques of this work is that it actually has no new empirical data in it, and I've struggled with this for quite a while. One way that I think about this is by thinking about what Mamdani says in When Victims Become Killers about area studies and about the way in which privileging the empirical is a way of turning our backs on the theoretical. But I realise that that's possibly not, it doesn't kind of get fully to grips with the critique about the empirical. And this kind of critique has come up again because, of course, the case of Bosnia was an ideal case for thinking about urban insecurity, because it was clearly happening in front of all our eyes. It was televised. There was a huge international presence, which meant it was well mapped and well documented. However, if we move on to think about unfolding urbanizations of insecurity, or ways in which security and the urban environment are intertwined, for example, in relation to critical infrastructure, these things are less well documented. And so the question about how one might become, or how one might think about how these things gather assemblages and constitute certain types of political subjects and constitute certain types of securities and insecurities, raises the question about how one, or whether one might need new empirical data here. And it does strike me that the one thing that I was very fortunate in was that there was this clear mapping of what was lost. And that actually is the hardest thing to actually research in many respects, and in terms of something like critical infrastructure, because of course you can't make these things visible in precisely the same way, partly because of the difficulty, they're buried beneath the surface often, but partly also because of the political sensitivity and the way in which nobody wants to make them visible. And without making them visible, some of the kinds of contentions about what things do can't be made, because you can't talk about the things themselves. There is another critique which somebody brought up with me about 6 months ago, which I think is also an interesting one, which is, if we're interested in materialities, we're interested in the way in which the non-human, this comes back to some of the things that were said in the last session, the non-human, such as the built environment, plays a role in security and political violence and so on, there is a danger of a kind of naive positivism returning into the work. I think I'm quite, I mean, this is why I kind of phrase the sort of question about how we know about things in Bennett's terms, in terms of a sort of naive or speculative posture, because I am aware that there is an assumption here that we can sort of know the presence of things. We can, if you like, affectively know the presence of things and their place in a particular kind of assemblage, or their place in a particular kind of milieu or something like that. And I struggle with that because that's, it seems to me, very close to accepting them as a kind of objective presence. And I suppose then it's a question of thinking about how that kind of naive posture feeds into a kind of politically and ethically motivated frame that then interprets what those things, the role those things play in constituting an assemblage. So I guess, and I'll conclude now because that takes me to 15 minutes, doesn't it? So I guess the important things when I worked through the case of Bosnia was that it was well documented, it was already historical, and that methodologically that made things a lot easier and meant that I didn't have to grapple with hard questions. But I think that reflecting on it, it does raise, and I know this has been partly discussed in the discussions about materiality, has raised interesting questions about how one gathers empirical data about things without allowing a kind of naive or insidious, if you like, positivism to creep back in.
Thanks, Martin. That's excellent. Now, there are two ways of proceeding. It just occurred to me it might actually be more interesting to pick up after each presentation a little bit the questions of methodology, because there's going to be different kinds of issues, methodological issues being raised. So what if I now open up, if there are any reflections? If not, doesn't matter, we can come back. It's not a judgment on the kind of presentation, but if we do a 5-10 minutes kind, not necessarily just questions to Martin, but also reflections on what's going on. Because there is a number of issues related about, which are at the heart of why we set up the case study idea, which is the relation between the theoretical and the empirical, which is partly to do with the bias in the way we conduct discussions in IR, partly, and political science more generally, where the theoretical is favored to some extent, even if one claims that it's empirical research. So that's one of the tensions. And the other was, which is specifically with regard to materialities, to which we might actually come back, which is this idea, which is also related to empiricism, that the things speak for themselves, right? And how do you do that? And what does that mean? And so I was wondering, and the way also the way Martin explains how he went about setting it up, what the issues were. So I don't know, is there anyone who has questions, a remark, wants to pick up? I think it would be good to do that, because the thing will be too diverse to actually, okay, Claudia? Whoa, good, 5. All right, let's take 2 and 1 go first. And then I want to go to the next presentation as well, you know. I knew that. Let's start there and we move that way. But we go.
Mine is very slow. Martin, I'm wondering why you feel that, the documentary material about the destruction and the mapping that you had did not count as empirical material. I'm thinking, I'm going to have a more important responsibility, the surface. Things are on the surface, this kind of.
It's about this idea of effective relationalities, about the idea that, particularly one of the things that defines the outputs of the project was the identification of affective, that is to say, non-cognitive responses to things like the built environment. Do you think that the identification of effective relationalities in that sense is distinctive to considering materialities, in the sense that it's something that we get to by going beyond the discursive and beyond the community?
Do you want to take these first?
Yeah, why don't I answer those two quickly, because I'm very bad at remembering more than sort of 2 or 3 things at once. Okay, so I mean, I think in the question you've identified sort of the kind of underlying critique of that kind of secondary data, right? And I think actually it's worth putting this in context, because although while methodology is a way in which we conceptualize and frame our work, it's also impinged on by certain pragmatic relations, and one of them is that you write something about violence in a particular place. Sometime, at some point, a publisher will inevitably send it to an area studies specialist. Right? And the area studies specialist will come back with, this tells me nothing new about the place. Right? because they'll say, we already knew that from report X, Y, and Z, right? And that what they'll say is that doesn't constitute the kind of getting out there and finding that kind of authentic material, you know, kind of that authentic data that nobody has found before, right? And so I suppose that's how that critique arose. Now, there is a secondary question, which is the kind of Iraq body count question, which is to what extent can you rely on, because a lot of part of this can be done through NGO reports, part of it can be done through IGO reports, part of it has to be done through kind of triangulating things through the media and so on. And of course, somebody will always come back to you and say that each of those constituencies has their own political and ethical stance, and therefore the data itself is not simply data, but is already encapsulated in a series of discourses, and they will try and kind of paint that as therefore not empirical material, but as already in a discourse, right? So, I guess that those were the two critiques that I became cognizant of. The other question is that one of the other things I'm aware of is that even by the time I came to write about it, it was history, right? I mean, it had happened in the sense that it had already been partly researched by other people. And I guess the question for me has increasingly become what would one need to do or to examine in order to see these kinds of material problems unfolding sort of right now, right? And that would require, we wouldn't have that kind of, you know, sort of big archive of documentation, and we would need to think about how we would do that. And obviously, somebody like me doesn't have the resources that maybe, you know, International Crisis Group has, so how would I do what they did on a macro scale, how would I do that on a smaller scale, I guess. Yeah, this point about affective relations, of course, I wrote it before that kind of grammar was available to me, and I very much see it like that. And I mean, I think there is, of course, you know, it's unfair because it's using discourse in a quite crude way, right? And although one of the reasons why I now frame what I did then, and I don't think it's twisting what I did then to make it look more kind of sophisticated or current than or something like that. What was happening then was that the discourse analysis was fairly crude. It was largely textual and it was sort of, you know, looking at speeches and largely linguistic utterances. And so there was this question, which has only, I think, recently been excavated by critical security studies, which was where I had my kind of academic home at that point, of there being a non-linguistic component to the dispositive, the assemblage, whatever you wanted to call it. Yes, and so then the question becomes, in an expanded sense of discourse, how do we capture this kind of sense, which in, for example, architecture might be, you know, there's that kind of sense of the building as uncanny, for example, you know, kind of sense and that kind of sense of disquiet, unhomeliness, and so on, which can then become a sense of loss when the building goes. How do we capture that beyond the kind of linguistic stuff about, well, what did it mean for this community or another community? I don't have an answer.
Shall we take the three questions, just as questions, and then... Yeah.
Well, I mean, mine is actually a general question, well, maybe even a proposition for what we might do, because we haven't really discussed what methodology means, so I guess methodology would be more or less knowledge about means. So perhaps we should sort of maybe develop the set of questions that we might ask ourselves as we're working on the method, sort of to what kind of knowledge does the method we use produce? How does this method and the knowledge we produce, how does that relate to practices of security, academia, politics? So what does it mean to use this method and what does it do? So we might say that certain sets of questions that we then ask ourselves as we work on these methods. So so that would actually produce knowledge on what we're doing. So that was just general idea.
Let's look at it.
Yes, a little bit the same question, because during your presentation you raised the question of what do you do to examine the loss of things, but you talk very little about your practice in the context of your research. What did you actually do? You talked about the maps, also about how people talk about the things lost. Does that mean that you went there and made interviews? How did you find these maps? How did you analyze them? You talk very little about this. Yeah, your research as practice.
My thought was similar to Fadi's in a way, that at the end you were musing on the danger of naive positivism. Mm-hmm. I want to push you a bit more on what you really meant by positivism, and whether I always try to insist on a distinction between positivism and empiricism, which denote a very different relationship to material. You could be swimming in empirical material, but not necessarily have any prior assumptions about what it means, how you interpret what sense it means. Whereas positivism implies something very law-based, model-based, a set of causal assumptions, perhaps. A naive empiricism might be a good thing, actually, compared to positivism, which comes with a whole different,
you know, baggage. Mm. Yeah. Okay. I'll leave the general question of what does methodology mean to be. I mean, I can say. I mean, the kind of knowledge it produces actually is. I wouldn't want to see it just simply as a knowledge, right? I mean, it's a political intervention. And the work that I've done has always been, the point of it has always been to produce an intervention which puts things that are already known to a certain extent into a framework that allows us to think them otherwise than they might have been thought to the present point, right? And in this case it was to think them otherwise than the kind of general silence that had fallen over this particular kind of destruction, right? That had seen it as a kind of barbarous, you know, excess or barbarous remainder that didn't need any kind of further comment. So it was to kind of, so in that sense, it's not a knowledge in the kind of, I suppose, in the, you know, because it's also a political practice, I guess. What did I do? Oh man, I mean. Well, I mean, of course, to me, it all looks pretty sort of. It doesn't have the kind of, and I think this has been the problem reflecting on the idea of methodology, right? And this has been the problem has been that, you know, that implies a certain amount of systematicity. I mean, or rather, in my mind, I've always been, you know, people have said, you know, well, what's the methodology? Because they wanted to imply a certain amount of systematicity. So, well, the mapping, I mean, in that sense, the mapping was pretty simple to research. I mean, you know, at that time, it was pretty easy to identify the main non-governmental and intergovernmental organizations that were working in Bosnia, particularly in the fields of post-war reconstruction and governance. And to go to those organisations and seek out the literature they were writing on post-war reconstruction, and to go through it looking for, you know, and that ranges from the European Council's reports through to, you know, architectural advocacy groups and so on and so forth, and to try and get a big enough sample and that things start repeating themselves, right? I guess that would be the first thing to say. The ethnographic... No, most of that was secondary again, and most of that comes from both anthropologists who were writing at the time. There was a fair amount of kind of anthropology of conflict, which was nascent at the time, but was, you know, developing at the time. But also kind of combing through as many sort of media reports as you can find, and those kinds of sources. There was a period of fieldwork, essentially based in Slovenia, but moving through Croatia and Bosnia from a base in Slovenia, because I've been concerned, and I remain concerned that, you know, when we tend to write about the city, you know, we write about the city we know, right? So we write about, you know, Sao Paulo as if it was Whitley Bay, right? So in that sense, so when I say we, I mean people who work in the Western Academy and in urban studies often. So, but I don't think, and yeah, there were certain kinds of notes taken, field notes taken there that you know were important comments that people made, stories people told. But it was essentially again enough to find that details started repeating, to find that you know there were kinds of comments that were being made that were taken to be significant because they start repeating. Andrew, yeah, that's an excellent point. But I think that there is a problem, and it's the problem I'm grappling with around the question of the non... I mean, and obviously, you know, there are people in the room who are far light years advanced around, you know, the question of assemblages and so on. But the way that assemblages have filtered through into critical security studies, I am actually concerned that it's not that distinct... That distinction, which is actually quite sophisticated, hasn't possibly been fully made yet. And by positivism, of course, you're right. You know, there is a whole law-like regularity implied there. But I was thinking more about the way in which, for example, we might think in international relations, thinking of realism being basically positivist, because it assumes that things are objectively knowable, right? And that it's that assumption that I wrestle with when we think about these kind of affective relations, right? You know, how do we know the kind of affective relation with the thing without accidentally assuming that the thing is sort of objectively knowable? Right?
Okay. Thanks, Martin. I think we leaved it here, and then thanks very much. That's a good start of the questions. I mean, we'll have to collate questions, but I think we'll have to do that towards tomorrow, because there's lots of stuff coming up, and the suggestion about raising questions we might work on at some point, on put it up, because we can work on the computers at some point. Now, there are people with PowerPoint presentations, so what I'll do is, if these can go first, right, if we then can move, and then we can move over there, so we can have more a kind of cross-cutting discussion, which is also a nice break to get up. So if we first, which cluster has PowerPoint? One, two. Oh, no, we all have, so we have three PowerPoints. Okay, good then, all right then, let's start here. You got a picture? No, so we have. Okay, then we stay here. Oh, we can turn it around.
Yeah, I think I'm going to speak 15 minutes.
Can you do 10 minutes?
No.
No, you have to. You have to. Otherwise, okay, that's good, but then there's no questions. Because okay. I have to run through five. I'm sorry. That's right.
Okay, let me start with two general questions. How did we choose the police kettle as the focal point of our case study? And second, how do we analyze the kettle from the perspective of our cluster? Both questions are mutually related. Nonetheless, the first points towards our intuition as researchers and our sense of topicality, whereas the second one involves theoretical work. The kettle can be described as a police tactic designed to encircle protesters and contain them in a cordon. It received broad media coverage by the end of last year in the context of the student protest in London. This picture was taken on December 9, when more than 1,000 protesters had been kettled for up to 8 hours in Parliament Square and on Waterloo Bridge. Under the impression of these incidents, Chris had the idea to analyze the police kettle as a distinct security technology. Although the kettle has to be seen in relation to broader topics such as public order policing and crowd behavior, it provided us with a relatively concrete and narrow focal point. In this sense, one should say that we have found a phenomenon worth of critical attention. However, it requires a theoretical frame and conceptual elaborations to turn this phenomenon into a research object. In this respect, our discussion on the forum proved ultimately fruitful for analyzing the kettle. Broadly speaking, we have extracted three analytical dimensions from our readings. Coming from Foucault, we understand genealogy as a historical method to investigate the emergence and transformation of practices in relation to forms of power, and hence the question would be, what is the genealogy of the police cattle? How does the practice of cattling correspond with rationalities of power identified by Foucault, sovereign power, disciplinary power, governmental power? Second, drawing on Deleuze and also on Luhmann, we also found it important to pay attention to temporal patterns, to temporal durations, to expectations of future events, to forms of acceleration and deceleration. And these aspects of time need to be explored with reference to the cattle. In short, what is the temporality of the cattle? Finally, reading Agamben on the dispositif and Brian Massumi on affect, we realized that both of the questions before are related to the problem of materiality. So how does the cattle function as a technology immanent to the contemporary security dispositif? And how is this technology involved in regulating, in the regulation of affect? I would like to sketch our preliminary answers to these questions, and in the closing section I will highlight the contested nature of cattling and try to give evidence for the critical potential of our analysis. Each genealogy has to identify the historical singularity of its referent of study. This is probably the most basic methodological imperative of any genealogical enterprise. But how did we identify the historical singularity of cattling? Following Foucault, we tried to relate the cattle to forms of problematization. First of all, the cattle corresponds with the problematique of the governmental security dispositif. This problematique is tied to the liberal ontology of circulation. The strategic aim is to secure a circulation of men and things against dangerous elements without hindering the circulation and its productive potential. The cattle refers to this liberal problematique since it divides the space of an urban environment. The cattle draws a boundary between an outside and an inside. People are included in a cattle in order to be excluded from urban circulation, whereas the mobile elements outside the cattle are secured in their movement. Very interesting is, in this respect, is something like it's called a mobile or a moving cattle, and we come back to this afterwards. Thus, the cattle divides the population. It is not directed at the population as a whole, but designed to isolate parts of it. These parts are problematized in terms of the crowd. Thus we have a related problematique in relation to the cattle, the police problematique of crowd control. From the late 19th century onwards, the crowd has been conceived of as an unruly mass, but something has changed during the last decades. We have found historical evidence that over centuries, the police favored crowd dispersal as a tactic vis-à-vis the unruly mass. Just think of water cannons, baton charges, tear gas, or the police formation of the flying badge, all devices that serve the purpose of putting a crowd to flight. However, this tactic of crowd control became problematized since the poll tax riots in 1990. According to Peter Waddington, an academic expert in policing, I quote him, dispersal was counterproductive. It only succeeded in spreading disorder, end of quote. As you can already sense, the cattle appears to be an appropriate answer to this kind of critique. Instead of spreading disorder, it purports to contain it. According to several news articles, it was not before the year 2000 that the cattle has been put into practice during May Day protests in London. However, this is not exactly true, as we have found out. At least in Germany, police forces have resorted to the cattle as early as 1968. This is the infamous cattle of Hamburg, in where around 800 people were held as captives for 13 hours. Although the courts have declared this containment to be illegal, the cattle has been used regularly in the following years, and not only regularly, but with increased frequency since 2000. How can one account for this increased frequency of occurrence? We believe that the reproblematization of crowd control tactics resonates with the transformation of protest. There is evidence that the symbolic mass protest has been supplemented by what we might call disruptive protest. The symbolic protest of the past is based on mass solidarity and stages the appearance of the people as a spectacle of opposition. In contrast now, the disruptive protest is based on mobile maneuvers directed against critical infrastructures. We might trace the history of disruptive protest back to the UK miner strikes in the early 70s, where flying pickets caused tremendous problems for the police. But the use of communication technologies during the WTO protests in Seattle took disruptive protest to another level. Since then, a new spatiality of protest has emerged that is based on decentralized hit-and-run tactics and on flash mobs. Currently, protesters try to adopt models of swarming. So-called out-of-control protest tactics deliberately attempt to blur the line between protest and the environment. Thus, we can observe a relationship of co-evolution between protest and police. The new choreographies of protest are seen as tactics to evade the kettle, while the kettle is designed to contain these new forms of protest. It is now the demonstrators who operate through dispersal, whereas the kettle is deployed to prevent dispersal. At the same time, we have analyzed how the kettle combines the spatial aspect of enclosure with the temporal aspect. Drawing on materials such as police manuals, media reports, blogs, legal texts, it becomes clear that the kettle has its own temporal structure. The temporality of the kettle is tied to the temporality of the crowd. The manual of the Association of Chief Police Officers states that the kettle allows for, quote, buying time. In this view, the kettle helps to extend the present state of affairs. It is a technique to hold the surprising possibilities of the future in store. Although the police kettle definitely has a military genealogy, just think of the siege or of tactics of encirclement, the kettle shall not subdue an enemy. It simply shall extend a period of time where protest is kept from its disruptive potential. The kettle constitutes a time of deferral. The movement of the protest is frozen with the sole purpose of releasing the protesters some hours later. But what is the strategic aim of this temporal tactic of deferral? We believe that the kettle can be interpreted as a technology that regulates the effective potential of the crowd. Following Masumi, effect inscribes future possibilities into the present. Effect is activating. It holds the promise of becoming. Our police expert, Professor Waddington, seems to understand this quite well when he writes, in a tension-filled environment, sparks will inevitably fly. Therefore, he advises kettling as a tactic to calm the situation. The kettle is a means to induce boredom, his words, into the turbulent passions of the crowd. In this sense, it is a patient technique that decelerates the dynamics of the crowd. Of course, such an anesthetics of the kettle can itself produce fear. This has certainly been the case in Copenhagen at the conference on climate change in 2009. Protesters were held about 4 hours on the ground in December, handcuffed, and without the permission to use toilet facilities, which means that they had to urinate on themselves. To be sure, the practice of kettling is essentially contested. In the public and in legal terms, it is especially telling in this respect that the police repudiate the term. During the evidence-giving session in the House of Commons after the G20 summit, Deputy Chief Constable Sue Sim declared, "I do not understand the term kettling." Together with other representatives of the police, she was denying that there has been a recent change in police tactics. Even more, she denied the very existence of that practice. Asked about the date when kettling has been adopted by the British police, she replied, "We do not kettle." Legal courts, however, have come to know that there indeed is such a practice. due to a longer tradition of cattling, especially German courts had more time to issue judgments. Looking on these legal sentences, it becomes clear that the legal prerequisites are quite demanding. Since the freedom of assembly is protected by the Constitution, the police have to declare the assembly to be dissolved before they cattle. They have to transform the assembly into a mere gathering. This process requires the police to wait a fair amount of time in order to allow each demonstrator to leave the scene. I think one does not have to resort to Derrida or Benjamin to notice that these temporal requirements are quite out of sync with the temporality of police. Whereas the police performs an art of the moment and operates in a situational space of discretion, the law binds it to orderly temporal steps. It doesn't come as a surprise that most of the cattling incidents of the past have been declared as unlawful, nearly all. Nonetheless, the cattle continues to be deployed with reference to the requirements of public order and security. This leads to the conclusion that the application of the cattle irreducibly relies on what one might call a petty state of emergency. The cattle exempts a particular space from its normal urban environment, and in this space, the captured subject is left abandoned by the law. I stop here.
Okay.
This is quite a nice cattle.
Yes. So we don't have much time to discuss. We have about 2 minutes left. So, except if you can ask your question quickly.
Oh yeah, that's great. Because I wanted to ask you about like non-Western type of demonstrations.
Mm.
If you look at the Korean example, I mean it's a pure confrontation. Where the cops just go there and they know they're gonna get beaten down, and it's just a rotation like the Roman army when you switch the front man because he's gonna be beaten down by the protesters. So there's no, and also the type of protest is highly organized when you have tens of thousands of guys seated and you just go like, you know, chanting. Mm-hmm. So to which extent your analysis of this genealogy is very Western and you draw it to crowd control, but also I think you should link it a little bit more to how protest has been evolving. And in 19th century is very key because you have urban warfare, you know, if you think that La Commune in Paris, mm-hmm. and the way Paris actually was designed, it's urbanity. That's the one part. And then there's also like in architecture, and I think like you have probably have stuff to say about China, I guess. But also, I was thinking about self-kettling. More and more, you see in certain crowds the auto-kettle themselves. You have their own internal security system, which kettles basically, like symbolically, the demonstration. So how do you weave in this into your genealogy? I will stop there.
Yeah, comments. I mean, I propose we don't have a big discussion about kettling because that would be fine. But I think that will lead us. There's no time, so I want to move around so the clusters can present how they went about. Thanks so much.
So we're the mapping cluster. And from the start, there's been a question of what do we mean by mapping as a cluster? What is our object of investigation? So to start, we've laid out that we first want to consider the process of mapping as what's being investigated. The map is an artifact. And then finally, the possibility of using mapping as our methodology for critical security studies. So all three of these things in one, trying to think through in this sort of circularity that was alluded to earlier, moving forward through an analysis of a case. So our objective today is to first give a brief introduction to our case, which is the social network analysis of terrorism, an emerging field of inquiry, how it is briefly, how it works, and then from there start to go into our methodological points that we use and we're thinking about when we did some analysis, and then finally what comes out of this process and what are some of the concepts that we can start to employ. And overall, our strategy here is to start to develop a catalog of concepts about mapping that can be employed both in the analysis of maps and the carrying out of mapping techniques. So,
Well, so let me try to explain social network analysis as briefly as I possibly can. Up on the PowerPoint here, the right image is a social network analysis map of the Al-Qaeda network, and to the left you see the Bali Bombers network. So keeping this in mind, I'm going to try and move through this. What is social network analysis? It's the study of social relations among a set of actors. It's essentially a mathematical tool which draws heavily on graph theory. It's used in sociology, biology, and mathematics, for example, to trace the spread of HIV, for example. But increasingly, it's used in the security sector for counterterrorism objectives. There, it's become a very sophisticated technology for identifying terrorist networks and, as such, creating a basis then for intervention and ultimately elimination. So network analysis operationalizes structures in terms of network linkages among units, and the units are also called nodes, are then sort of the people that you see on the map there as well. So the social network perspective views characteristics of the social units as arising out of structural or relational processes and focuses on properties then of the whole relational system. Now, what does that mean? It means that the focus are not the actors themselves, but rather relations between them. It's about identifying who knows whom and in what way, how strong is the relation between them. And this connection, these links, can be mathematically calculated. SNA comes with its own set of metrics and measurements, so you can calculate betweenness and centrality and closeness. Moreover, SNA can qualify these relations. So, for example, you can categorize for liking, A likes B, or for hating, B hates C, or giving money, or who gives whom orders. And as such, SNA qualifies... So as such, you create these categories that are then numerically encoded in a spreadsheet that then allows for digital representation and analysis. So the network, as you can see, depicts structures of relations between the nodes. So on the one hand, you see clusters of very well-connected nodes and then pockets of isolation. Of course, on the one hand, you can say the objective in a more sociological way is to understand how also called dark networks work. But in the more immediate military objective, it's to see how you can best destabilize them and most effectively. So let me just say very briefly a couple of sentences about how the process of doing SNA actually works. So it starts with an event, for example, looking at a video that's been uploaded about a terrorist attack or a website. Or it starts with a suspect or a group of suspects. And then through the use of now very sophisticated software, the web is trolled for connections to this event or to the suspect or group of suspects. And these connections can be other URL or IP addresses or connections mentioned in other documents or reports. Importantly, the data collection process is dependent on the starting point. So somebody needs to say this is the event or this is the suspect. And this is then, in this case, provided by the military as the map commissioner. They may also provide, in some cases, sets of data gathered themselves through their own intelligence, or even, as we found out, through interrogations. So the software that's now available can handle vast amount of data and a whole variety of data sources as well, from not just newspapers, but trial transcripts, all sorts of documents and reports. As mentioned earlier, then, once the data is extracted from the source, it is categorized and numerically encoded, for example, in an Excel sheet. These are two steps that already provide a point of view based on what categories are chosen and how this encoding, this numerical encoding, actually works for this digital representation. As such, it became apparent that the process of SNA mapping had several layers, from identification of the starting point, which represents an assumption, to the data provision, what kind and by whom, data selection, what is good data, what's not good data, to extraction from the original source to the categorization and the encoding. So, of course, SNA comes with its problems, and these are not only voiced from sort of outside the camps, but also from within. So, for example, there are questions of temporality. As you see there, this is a static representation. SNA cannot really account for change or growth, which then means that the point of mapping then might interfere or contradict the point of actual intervention. Now, as Krebs, who's an SNA practitioner, also puts forward, he says the problem is also collecting the right kind of data. You need to be able to understand sociology and communication. There's this problem called the pizza delivery guy problem, where you confuse frequent connections with significant connections. Just because you see the guy most often doesn't mean that he's actually very important. So, and as such, the network map hides and has made invisible all these different problems in the back. So let's move on to the methodological points because we have to hurry up.
So how we went about doing this is, first of all, we didn't lay out in advance how we would go about studying maps. We started slowly and sort of snowballed the process of analysis. But that being said, we didn't start from nowhere and we weren't blank slates going into this. So in the back of our minds, I think the two most important themes and the two most important methodological points had to do with the study of practices and the study of maps as a technology. So we wanted to think, rather than what's wrong with this map, think how was the map created, how is it used, where does it go, how does it circulate? Think about the complete picture of the moving from place to place within this. And then, secondly, what does the map do and how does it do terrorism? Hopefully some of this. Some of the strategy we've been doing is trying to outline different communities of practice in this SNA community. So we have SNA theoreticians. These are mathematicians, sociologists, anthropologists. Well, we have security agencies. And then we have this third community, which is compatible technologies. And this is everywhere from drone technologies to eavesdropping technologies to software producers who sell the software for profit. And then we have, in this Venn diagram, the sections where there's the negotiated spaces between these locations, with intervention and elimination of individuals being the most radical or the most drastic, but also the procurement of computational technologies, and then military operations in the field. And what we should emphasize is this is not to suggest that all of these people work seamlessly together. Rather, there's still some conflict. So, for instance, the Army, there's a term called mosaic philosophy in the collection of data and interrogation, trying to extract as much information as possible. Some theoreticians are very opposed to this and want to distance themselves from potential human rights abuses. So there's discontinuity within this practice as well. So the three methodological points that we've come out of this so far with is, first of all, thinking about point of view and imagination. And this is an image that is within one of the most prominent SNA practitioners, Chen. One of his documents explaining to more a lay audience what is social network analysis. And so our question from here is, where is this precisely? We're trying to think through maps and think about what are the mentalities of mapping that are involved. How do these mentalities influence activities? For instance, we're interested in how topological thinking and personal relationality dictate provisions in the collection of data. So we want to think about, as Deleuze and Guattari might say, the rhythm of mapping, the rhythm of thinking, the rhythm of territorialization. How does this make action, and how do we think through what this does in people's minds? So at the one hand, we want to be wary of mapping and spatial metaphors, but yet it seems that critical security studies and security studies is drawn to mapping metaphors and images. And so we're trying to negotiate this tension. What does it mean to think mapping? And you want to go to the next two?
The last two that we've got, one is spatiality and the other one is representation. So just to continue this question, where is this network? It seems that through social network analysis, or it seemed to us, that a process occurs which extracts the social somewhere where of this network of the suspect, the terrorists, and places it into this virtual environment. So And as this process occurs, the relationality between the commissioner of the map, the mapper, and the mapped is actually altered. So the locus of the represented social actually changes, and we would like to think this through what that actually means. So in our case, in the counterterrorism context, this then could possibly mean that as in the virtuality, just the nodal points are depicted and their relations within this non-geographical space, then feeds into objective of a dehumanized target that is then possibly eliminated. So what we're trying to do is think spatiality through in a sort of extended way. So think spatiality outside of the geographical, which on the one hand is difficult, but at the same time we think actually is a possibility. We should probably leave the drone attacks for now, right? So the last point is representation. We think that it's one of the main kind of issues that we've been grappling with. If we're trying to sort of pursue an anti-foundationalist sentiment without at the same time then reifying structures through mapping. So what does that mean? We've sort of come to the preliminary conclusion that we can't solve the problem of representation, but we can situate our method and the map within an appropriate constellation of other mappings and maps. And so we think that through possibly creating a dialogue with other representations, we can allow for critical evaluation, which relativizes then a very strict reification of representation. So, and as such, we think that we could maybe possibly deal better with the problem of the map as an authority of truth, which we've alluded to earlier. Yes, I think we'll stop.
Okay,
there.
Thanks very much.
Sorry, this was slightly condensed.
One question for 1 minute.
General comment as well.
Yeah.
Just having those, so you can see what this is. This is drone attacks mapped with GIS software, and then a list of fatalities as broken down to militant leaders, high-value targets, militants, and then just the rest. So this is the rough landing of an SNA map, perhaps.
Sorry. But I think when we discuss methodology across the board, we should include ethics. Mm-hmm. Because with this interrogation, human rights violations, nuclear weapons and stuff like that, things get very nasty very fast, so... Mm-hmm. I think we really need to give the ethical aspects.
We completely agree. Yeah.
Just an organizational question. Don't we have the time to move two presentations until tomorrow? Because I find it a little bit unsatisfying to have 15 minutes for such a very great. I mean, this is the core of our work in a way. And
we actually don't have time tomorrow, unless you want to stay an extra hour tomorrow. So I think, I mean, the way you see the collaboratory, I've emphasized it in the beginning, this is a way of throwing elements in. I think the big questions we have to come back to are the questions that were raised about methodology, which is the work we need to do tomorrow. And so this is representing, you should put this into the collaboratory so people can go back to it. So there is a virtual kind of component. We have to come back. This is not a conference where we present papers continuously. Today we're collecting information together, questions. Some of us will need to do some work tonight somehow to run the session tomorrow to come back to the bigger question about methodology if we want to work on that, what questions are involved. I know this is unsatisfactory, but somehow it's a matter of showcasing what you've done and how you've worked, so we can actually come back tomorrow when we talk. Because tomorrow the talk will be about how do you bring work together around questions of intervention in methodology. So you can come back, but we need this as reference points for tomorrow.
I also think, without a doubt, we'll be having these conversations tonight anyways, explaining our work, so...
Yeah, that's why it's difficult to sort of answer, like, we've definitely dealt with ethics... You know, they're used for killing people, those maps. So we thought about this, but we didn't have time to include it.
Can I propose we do it that way? Because otherwise we won't... I mean, because there is a lot of... There's more substantive work done on the cases that I expected would have been done as well. I thought it was much more reflections on the methodological principles. So it's actually very nice to have it. That's why it's frustrating, I agree. John, very quickly, can I take the questions and then we move on? Because otherwise we're never going to get...
Just a comment. I'm just thinking the opposite then. Can we just do all the presentations and have people kind of write down questions?
We can do that as well. Yeah, if
so
you
that. Kind of open up in the end, everyone.
Okay. Shall we do that? Good. Let's next. Then the next presentation.